This is Ann Peckham. I'm doing oral histories for the University of Wisconsin Oral History Program. I'm here with Don Klimpel in his home. It is April 23rd, 2002. And Don, we're very happy that you're giving us time to do this.
Thank you.
And I hope that you will tell us a little bit about where you were born and a little bit about your family.
I was born and raised in Minot, North Dakota. The first 16 years of my life, I lived on a farm. I had one brother and one sister. And we lived in a community on the farms with Klimpel community, which today there's still about 700 Klimpels in that area, and they all have farms. I then went to a high school in Minot, North Dakota, a Minot model, which was a normal school, campus school, teacher's college school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd have student teachers from the college come over and teach our classes. Graduated in 1958, had a scholarship to go to Minot State Teachers College at that time, and had no idea what I wanted to do in college. So the first year in college, I did a little athletics. I didn't study too hard and just really didn't have any direction that I wanted to go in. Five of us at the end of the first year in college decided we'd volunteer for the draft. So at that time we volunteered, went into the Army. We spent 2 years in the Army, all five of us. Two of us were together all the time. It was a very eye-opening experience for me, and probably was the start of one of the careers that I had and maintained over the years. When I came back from the military, I went back to that teacher's college, and I also got married that year. Colleen, my wife, was a high school sweetheart, and so we got married then. And spent one more year in the state teacher's college, and I played softball that summer, and one of the guys playing softball with us was a pharmacist. And he said, "Why don't you think about going into pharmacy school?" Well, at that time I knew I couldn't be a coach, or I didn't want to be a coach or a high school teacher of any kind. So I then picked up, Colleen and I moved to Fargo, found a little Norwegian family, and we lived upstairs in their house. And I went to pharmacy school in Fargo for the next 3 years and graduated with a five-year degree in 1965. Upon graduation, I really didn't know which direction I wanted to go in pharmacy. I thought probably hospital pharmacy was probably where I wanted to go. I didn't really want to go into retail at that time. So I did an internship in Louisville, Kentucky, in a VA hospital. And so I spent we spent a year in Kentucky. Loved it, it was a great time. But that year at my internship, I wasn't really sure I wanted to be a pharmacist either. I thought more along the lines of medicine. I thought I'd probably want to be a doctor. My boss in Louisville, Kentucky was a Madison, Wisconsin resident, and he suggested, why don't I go up to Madison, visit the university, and look at their graduate school in pharmacy, and could stay with his mother, because his mother still lived here. So Colleen and I took a trip, a long weekend, to come up to Madison, and we looked at the school, and we decided to come up here for graduate school. So then in 1966, we moved to Madison, and I started graduate school, master's program in hospital pharmacy, which also had a residency program along with it. And so I was a resident at the VA hospital, going to school at the university for the next 2 years. And at the end, I would have a master's in hospital pharmacy. And I probably could have gone into the VA anywheres, and they wanted me to go. But at that time, 1300 University Avenue, University Hospitals, I had worked with a lot of the people over there. And Wynn Durant, who was the director of pharmacy at that time, said, why don't you come to work for us? So in 1968, that's when my actually medicine career started. I went to work at the old University Hospitals, as I call it, and had a dual appointment between the school pharmacy and the hospital. So I taught graduate students in school pharmacy and worked in the hospital. And just I did service things online. We were setting up unit dose at that time in the hospital. And so I was doing that. And then I moved up to supervisor. And then I moved from the supervisor status, I moved into associate director of pharmacy. And that was over a period of maybe 8 years. And then about 1974, we decided to build the new hospital, or the hospital was at least a possibility that we would have a new hospital on the west side of campus.
So, now, before we go into the new hospital, let me ask you, what is the difference between hospital pharmacy and retail?
Or any other, mm-hmm. research? Well, actually, the big distinctions in pharmacy education right now is you got hospitals, retail, which is the Walgreens, and our time there was a Rent-A-Bombs at that time, those types of pharmacy, the corner drugstore,
mm-hmm.
and actually research or industry. That's the three big areas. However, presently there's about 125 different professions that the pharmacist upon graduation can go into. So there's a lot of different things that they end up doing. But those are the three main categories, and a lot of people are attracted to those areas. But the hospital is just working in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
simply as a hospital pharmacist. Now, it's more clinical. It's more clinical oriented. You don't do merchandising.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that always appealed to me, anyway, helping others and the service part of it.
Now, this unit dose...
Okay.
I had a little nurse's training way back in 1942 and 3, and we did everything on the floor.
Oh, sure.
I mean, if you were going to give somebody morphine, you had started with a little pill and sterile water. So yep. Tell us about unit dose.
In the 1960s, there was a number of pharmacy programs in the country, Kentucky, Ohio State, and Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, that came up with the innovation of why should we have floor stock or bottles of medications on the floors? Why should we have people send them a bottle and then they discontinue a med and then we have to throw them all away? We can't reuse them. So they came up with a concept at that time of unit dose, one medication packaged in some kind of package that indeed a patient would take, either administered by a nurse, a pharmacy technician, or whoever. And but every dose would be individually packaged. That's the concept of unit dose. And then we carry that concept on a little bit further when we move to the new hospital, and I'll talk about that later or whenever you want me to. Those concepts are what really helped us in planning the new hospital. That concept, at least for the pharmacy and materials management part of it, was going to be a part of the new hospital. So we had to design and set up different kinds of technology things for the new hospital. So,
and you were instrumental in this planning? And
In 1974, when we started the planning, yes, we would form together in groups in the hospital. I think probably the person that did most of the at least direction and leading of the groups was a person by the name of Dick Reynolds and Francis Chung. They were both management engineers that worked for the hospital at that time. And they would come to the different departments and they have some good ideas also on engineering and how things should be put together, how things should move, and new technology ideas. And we just put out all of our ideas. They put them down on paper. They worked out PERT charts and all the types of things that we had to do to set a system together like that, which meant doing functions that other departments would do, pharmacy may do, changing the concept of food service and all the distribution systems in a hospital. We changed all that, and they were instrumental in actually putting all of it together and helping us plan it for the new hospital.
Were they regular employees of the hospital,
yeah,
or were they brought in just to do this planning?
They were actually members. At that time, they were brand new in the hospital also. Dick Reynolds and Francis Chung. Dick Reynolds has just now left the hospital, and that's quite a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Chung left after we got into the new hospital and pretty well organized. Francis Chung then went to the University of Michigan. But they were kind of the ones that helped us do the planning. In 1976, when they start building the hospital then, since I was involved at that time also with materials management, as we called it. At that time, we still called it pharmacy. Today, we call it materials management. We needed somebody out in the new facility just to receive things and help, once they start getting the structure up, to learn the building and learn how things would flow in the building, because it was very, very big and a very complicated building to learn. So, and the building itself had many new concepts of design as far as interstitial space and all those types of things that were just new for everybody. So we had somebody out there in 76 in the new hospital, and then, as you well know, in 1979, when we made the big move, there was a massive planning put together for moving everything out there in a couple days. Reynolds moving, I think, was probably the biggest help that we ever had. The military helped. A lot of people helped in making the big move to the new hospital. It was a great move.
And I put in a plug for the volunteers there, because we packed up the patients' personal items and greeted them at the door.
Everybody was helping.
It was very exciting.
Yeah. The patient move was especially successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything just went just like clockwork, and it was all done in actually 1 day or 2 days. So. Mm-hmm. But it was great. So.
The actual delivery system, I can remember when we were giving tours of the hospital before any patients or anyone really moved into it, I can remember that central services and the pharmacy and the delivery system of all that.
It's actually a concept. It's a Gordon Friesen concept. Gordon Friesen was a Canadian architect, a hospital administrator, and his theory and his part of his philosophy in hospitals was that we needed to keep the nurses and the doctors as closest to the patient so they didn't have to run for one thing. So therefore, in the new hospital, not only did we have an ACL, automated delivery system, for carts and things to the different floors, we also had nurse servers, which we would keep all different kinds of supplies, and some places they actually kept medications in, along the bedside, so nurses didn't have to run for all these things. That was the concept that we put together, or we went along with and developed for the new hospital. So all the automation, the delivery carts, food service coming into that, pharmacy carts going to the floor on the automation, all the supplies going to the floors on the automation. We don't tie up elevators. We had our own elevator systems, and everything was delivered. So indeed, we didn't need people to push them, because the carts would automatically do it. So over the years, we saved many hours of man hours, and it has made it very efficient. And the OR system, operating room systems, we set up special procedures and special delivery systems to them using automated system also. And so not only did, in the concepts, we also had taken all the reprocessing out of the operating rooms and put it centrally in central services. So indeed, we would do all the instruments. We would do all the reprocessing of the instruments and sterilization. And on demand, They would send us lists of cases they were going to have. We would then deliver to them a case cart with all their instruments, all their supplies, anything they needed for that surgery. And that's what how the system developed and still running today. So,
it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is a great system. At one time, we were going to do a manpower study. We never really got the data together on how many dollar savings over the years would this automated system have given us. We never did put that together. It would have been a good study, though. Mm-hmm.
Now, pharmacy and central services were...
We were all together.
Actually all together.
In the, I'll call it 1300 University Avenue, the old hospital. They were together. We moved to the new hospital in 79. They were still together. And then after about, it was probably about 1982, 83, Gordon Durzon, whenever he was here, he had been here for a year or two at that time, in his infinite wisdom, decided he would split that out and leave pharmacy standalone and call all the rest of it materials management. And that's when we started materials management. That was purchasing, that was central services, that was the receiving dock, the mail room. All those things went into materials management then.
Now, you were involved in that, though.
I was director of
it. Yes.
So that was a big part of it. And at that time, I either had to decide, was I going to stay in the pharmacy side of it, or was I going to go into the materials management side of it? And I opted to go into the materials management side. But I still kept very close involvement with pharmacy because I still taught graduate students and was involved in that group of people. So mm-hmm. Very close contact. It was a wonderful time for me. I enjoyed it a whole lot.
Well, you must have had a lot of people working for you.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. In the materials management area, when we do budgets, we had, actually we were responsible for about $50 million worth of stuff, dollars worth of supplies and things. We had about a little over 100, maybe 110 employees that we'd usually have, full-time equivalents. We had students working for us also, lots of people. Yeah, it was a big organization, actually, a big department.
This budgeting, remembering how university worked, did you have to put everything out for bids?
That's a requirement. Yes, you do. That actually was sometimes very difficult and time-consuming, mm-hmm. and that's one of the things that led to public authority, actually, also.
Public authority?
Yeah, the public authority where the hospital pulled away from the university. Mm-hmm. In certain parts of purchasing, they were able to do their own purchasing and have their own autonomy. Things could be much faster, but we still had to bid things out, but we could do it faster. And we never really ever had to take the cheapest product. We could always claim that this is what we wanted. We could get what we wanted. Usually we didn't have to always take the cheapest thing on the market, like a lot of people think. But we could, once we became public authority, the university, the hospital, we could do it faster. Otherwise, it was very cumbersome before, and we'd have to go through 750 Peterson Building, through all their purchasing systems. They would have to put the bids out, and then it was very cumbersome. So that's what helped, part of the thing that helped us become a little more independent. And
you were working?
Oh, yes.
And when it became public authority?
Oh, yes.
What year was that? Do you remember?
I don't remember. It was probably in the 90s, but I don't remember exactly when in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Maybe 94 or somewhere. Because like mm-hmm. A lot of things happened in the 90s. My military career took a little bite at that time because, indeed, that's where we spent some time in Desert Storm also. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in the hospital. So...
We want to get to that because that does come in. I see here.
Okay. Yeah. Let me.
72 to 88. You were.
Yeah. Let me talk about actually until 98 to 2000. I was in the reserves actually. If I go back a minute to North Dakota. When I volunteered for the draft in 1958, we were enlisted, and we spent 2 years in the military, or I did, with four other guys. I then got out of the military, and you have an obligation for 7 years or 8 years at that time. So you had to be in some kind of call-up control group, as they called it at that time. But after 8 years, I received my discharge, and I had been moving in my career at that same time. So I got my discharge from the Army. I then, decided to go to graduate school in Wisconsin, completed graduate school, and then I decided maybe I want to go back into the military. I enjoyed the military. I like regimentation. I like all these kinds of things and so on. Indeed, I then applied for a direct commission after I finished graduate school here. And lo and behold, we have a hospital unit here in Madison, and they gave me a direct commission as a captain that time in 1972 in the reserves at the 44th General Hospital in Madison. I came in as a pharmacist into a blood unit, actually, at that time, but it was a detachment of the 44th. Otto Poles, who is a longtime resident of Madison, a pharmacist and a very good friend of mine. He was the chief pharmacist out at Mendota for many, many, Central Colony, as we used to call it, for many, many years, since retired. Actually brought me into his unit, and I then spent the next 72 until actually 2000 in the 44th, or its detachments. And we had many, many different experiences at that time. That's when the whole concept of the hospitals were changing in the Army. Also at that time, we went away from a lot of the big hospital complexes. We were classified as a general hospital at that time, which meant if we were to set up tentage and all that stuff, it'd take about 35 acres to do it for a hospital, all under tents, very complicated, very big. We had all the specialties. We could do everything. We had about 700 people at that time also. And our locations, if we would go to war, we'd always be a long ways away from the front lines, because indeed they would bring us patients from the front lines. The concept was changing at that time to go to smaller hospitals and ones that were more mobile. So they came up with a concept called DepMeds, Deployable Medical Systems, actually is what that means. And everything was modular. Like the ORs were in like vans. The new tents, tents where we'd keep patients and eat and do all the rest of things, were air conditioned, had floors in them, had lighting systems in them. I mean, they're very, very nice, and that's what they're using yet today. But you could break off a module, whether it be a pharmacy module, a lab module, an OR module, and you could move it down the road, or you could move it, you could fly it across the ocean. And that was the new concept, and it works very well. And then along came Desert Storm, and indeed, we were one of the few. We were still a general hospital at the time, was called to duty, and we were called to Germany, actually. So we took about 720 people, and went to our flag, and the majority of our people, 300 of them, roughly, went to Landstuhl, Germany, which is the premier hospital in Germany, because they have all the different services, specialties and services at that hospital. And it was only about 5 miles from Ramstein Air Force Base. And all the patients from the desert that needed care outside of what they could do in the desert, they would fly to Ramstein, and then they would helicopter them or deliver them by ambulance to Landstuhl. And we ended up seeing about 2,800 patients at Landstuhl. Of the actual war patients, I suppose we saw maybe 20, 25 of those. Of the actual battle casualties, friendly fire, that type of thing. All the rest were people falling out of trucks or getting stabbed or what happens with a community of 500,000 people. We saw all the rest. It was, we spent about 3 months. Some people spent 4 months there. And I originally said there was about 300 of us in Landstuhl. The rest of them, we farmed out. They went to different parts all through Europe, all through Germany especially. And we had them in Turkey, and we had them in Italy. Parts of our people, specialty people, that would fill in these other places. And so one of my delightful duties at that time then was to at least make sure that we kept in touch with these people. So I'd get to travel around and go see all these people. So that was a great time for me. And I mean, it was a serious time, but it was also a great time. It was, and we lost, just by putting some of our people out, you lose your autonomy. And they feel like there's nobody there that wants to take care of them. So, you know, you just lose a little bit. So you have to try to keep in touch with them. And we tried to do that, not always to the best we could have, but we didn't. We didn't do that. So after 3 months, we came back. And then in 1995, the 44th General Hospital was deactivated. The 44th General Hospital was mainly a hospital that was set, started in Boston, Massachusetts. And then it was deactivated. And then it was reactivated in the Second World War, and Dr. Weston was a commander that left Madison with the group from Madison that went to, actually they went to Leyte, and they went to Australia and then Leyte, and they were very, many honors. They got streamers for taking prisoners and fighting away the Japanese, and they did an excellent job over there. And many of the medical schools, physicians, nurses from the nursing school, were from Madison in the 44th General Hospital. So after we were deactivated in 95, I kind of decided, I hate to see all the history of the 44th lost or just forgotten about. So I got a group of people together that had been active. One of the individuals that had even been to Leyte was in that group, Dr. Jertsen, Chet Jertsen. And we put together a display. And the display is absolutely wonderful. The medical school actually did the display for us. So it's real high tech. And it center panel has all the commanders, the legends on what the unit has done over the years, and all their honors. And then on one of the panels, on the left panel, we have shown the Second World War, and again, people that were there, and pictures of it. And then on the right panel, we did Desert Storm panel. We didn't really try to concentrate on anything that happened in between those big years, as I call them. And we now have the display is complete. It has been set up once in the VA already. The University Hospitals have set it up a number of times. And we opted to give University Hospitals control of the display. So indeed, somebody would always have it and keep care of it. And then the other they would also rotate it to the other hospitals in Madison if they would like to display it in their lobbies or wherever they like to display it. It's all they have to do is set up a schedule with the hospital. The War Museum uptown in Madison also has said that periodically they would pull the display and display it up there in the War Museum also.
I should think so. Yeah. They have a lot in that museum.
Oh, yeah. And then we had the public information. People did an article for us and put it out in all the public papers, little town papers. Mm-hmm. And what we're hoping will happen is over the years, we've probably had 10,000 Wisconsin people in the 44th General Hospital. But it's all over Wisconsin, not just Madison. So we're hoping that some of those people might be interested in pulling that display and using it for whatever, sometimes, for their own use.
That's marvelous.
So that was a fun time for us.
I should say so.
That's good. So that's the 44th.
Well, let me ask you, did you ever set up this tent hospital?
Oh, yes, we did, many times.
Did you really?
That's actually what we would do in our...
when you went to summer camp
or
something? Yeah,
we call it annual training because summer camp is no longer... You don't always go in the summer. We would go in the nice time of the year, and you know, we would go any time. But we did. First of all, we were trained, actually was trained in Texas to do it. That's where you originally get your basic training on setting up all the equipment and things. And then later we set it up in Mississippi, Shelby, Mississippi. We've set it up in...
Don, you were telling me that you set it up in Shelby, Mississippi?
And, yes, and also in Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, many times. Actually, there's a active duty military site in Fort McCoy, and they bring all different kinds of hospital units in to set up and tear down and learn about the systems. Because all the modular systems have to fit together just so, and it's really fairly technical to get it set up, but it's absolutely it's a great facility.
Who was the commanding officer of this? Was he regular Army?
Of the one in Fort McCoy?
No, the 44th General. 40,
it was always our commander, always a doctor. Most of them were from university hospitals. As I had mentioned earlier, Dr. Weston was the first commander. Mm-hmm. He actually wasn't first. He was the second commander, but he was a commander. He was made commander when he went to Leyte. We ended up with, on deactivation, Haywood Gilliam, Brigadier General, was our commander. We've had, I could name some of them, Steve Babcock, Jim Brandenburg, Dr. Sims, Dr. Longley, Chet Jurtson was a commander for a while. We've had about 15 commanders over that period of time that I remember. Is that enough about the 44th?
Well, it is unless you have something else you want to talk about.
That was a big part of my life, and it was a very good part of my life.
Well, I remember when you all went off to... to Germany, and it was pretty traumatic for
everybody.
It
was, and it was hardest on the families, we left behind. That was, I think, probably the hardest part. So I really have to try to understand the people in the Second World War and the First World War. They had it even harder than we did.
They were gone a lot longer.
Yeah, and this was really tough. But this was very difficult for us. About 5% of all the people that went to Desert Storm had problems adjusting and had to be sent home. So it was a pretty good percent of people that had to come home, and for many, many different reasons.
Well, you had some nursing mothers amongst your nursing staff.
Yeah, we did.
That would be really hard.
Yeah, we pretty much tried to look at that before we left. And some people actually didn't get to go because of their commitments they had here at home, that they needed to stay at home. But we took people along with us that actually were expecting and were pregnant at that time. And it worked out fine.
Oh, dear. There's one thing I want to get back to the new hospital. Because I used to, you had a lot of employees, 100
110, 100,
something like that. I used to see handicapped youngsters coming in with their minders, and they always headed down.
Area.
How did you get started on that? I presume
the city has a program, finding places that handicapped young adults or young people can work, that might be able to work and at least try to develop a little more skills for themselves and things that they can do that just to help other people. And the city really, we tied into that, and we used the handicap a lot in the reprocessing area. They could page instruments, they could do a lot of paging things where they could sit down. They didn't, it's pretty mundane types of things that they had to do, but they loved to do it, and we would have parties for them and stuff too. You know, they just really fit in. It was a nice situation. Sometimes people might think it's a little bit of a headache, but indeed they're just marvelous people, and they worked well for us. So it was a good program.
So any repetitive jobs they were
able
to do?
Almost anything repetitive they could do. You couldn't send them off to other places or other departments or run around much. So you had to keep them pretty well restricted and monitor it a little bit. But we had them, actually we even had them in the mailroom. So we had them in the mailroom, reprocessing area. So.
Now you had to put together the mail, the pharmacy, central supply, laundry.
Yeah, laundry service, that was a big part of it too, yeah.
The laundry all went someplace else.
Yeah. Well, we have an off-site laundry. It's called MUHL, Madison United Hospital Laundry Service. And they actually process linens for, in Madison, many of the clinics, university hospitals, Meritor Hospital. We never did St. Mary's. And the VA does their own in Toma. But outside hospitals, we did Janesville, a number in the area, Fort Atkinson at one time. We did a lot of different hospitals. They would do about, they processed about 12 million pounds a year of linen. And that was all outside. And what they would, and they would take out the soil and process it, bring us back clean, and whatever we required. And great facility. I mean, great. When I retired from the university in 1998, University Hospital, they didn't have a general manager at MUHL, and so I spent 3 months as a general manager out there, waiting for a general manager to come. And I learned a whole lot more than I thought. I knew everything about linen, but I learned a lot about the linen and the processing when I was out there. Nice facility, and they also have some great personnel. Are usually most of them are Spanish speaking, or only Spanish speaking. And what MUHL has done is they give them courses during the day on English speaking courses. And so they have classes while they're at work, and it's absolutely great. It's great for the employee. It's great for MUHL, and they have. Just a nice organization out there too. So
that's
very nice. Yeah.
Now before that, you went to the prison up in Waupun or something, didn't you?
Yeah,
the laundry.
That's where it used to go many years ago, and we were still in the old hospital for a while. I went to Waupun for processing. That's exactly what it was. So,
were you responsible for the food services also?
No.
The delivery of the food?
Only the delivery.
Just the delivery.
We had a schedule because carts would have to come from food service on a certain schedule, and then they would come into our system. They would then be delivered to the floors, and what would happen when they delivered to the floors, they would unload automatically now, and the distribution people would then take that cart on the floor and take it to a nursing unit and put it in a refrigeration unit. And then that they just waited for the people to process the meals at that time on the floors. So similar to pharmacy, the drug carts would come out, the unit dose carts would come out of pharmacy at a certain time during the day, and we would also then distribute them to the floors also. So that's kind of how that.
And the mail all went along with this?
Mail was a little bit different. We would sort and separate mail. We had a high volume of mail at the University Hospital. We would deliver mail, just like postmen we would use.
we would deliver mail, because indeed it was too difficult to at a certain time send a nursing unit's mail up on the ACL or on the automated system. So we would hand deliver the mail. So we didn't really use a lot of automation for the mail. We would use a tube system once in a while for mail, the pneumatic tube system. Mm-hmm. And that was another innovation of high tech that was coming around in hospitals that we also put in. So we could, small items we could deliver in a pneumatic tube to many, many different places in the facility.
You could deliver some medications that way.
Yeah, we did medications also.
Mm-hmm. What is this ACCO system?
It's American Chain and Cable Company is what that means. But that was an acronym we picked up for the automated system. And we picked that up as they were putting the new system in. Mm-hmm. In 79, then we call it the ACCO system. That's the automated cart transportation system.
I see. How much of all this was in the interstitial spaces?
I remember that
there's a almost a floor in between.
There is.
Occupied floors.
But mainly that's electricity, the heating systems, all that types, some ventilation fans, some of those things are in the interstitial space. We don't have any of the cart system in them. Any parts of it, we may have some braces that hold up part of the track and stuff in the interstitial, but otherwise we don't have any of that in the interstitial space. Mm-hmm.
Was there anything in that building that we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention? It's such an awesome building.
Yes, it is, and it's getting bigger and bigger all the time. I think, you know, the biggest plus, I think, or the biggest difficulty is for people to get around in the building. And we've tried to, by signage, different kinds of signs, and the great volunteers that we have, you know, escorting people around and showing them where to go and stuff and telling them where to go. That was probably one of the biggest challenges of the hospital, and still is today, I think, is getting the right types of mm-hmm. signage so people can get around in that facility. It's a wonderful facility, but it's very complicated. If you get lost, you get discouraged. You get, you know, and you do. You know,
they do.
Yeah. So, and it's a tough time. So, you know, and I think, you know, from an administrative point of view, you know, the hospital, our goals were pretty much all the years that I worked there was, you know, patient care service was, you know, like our number one. And that was one of our top goals. Education, research, and outreach. And outreach really came into its own in the last, you know, maybe 10 years or so that we really start developing outreach. But, you know, those goals were always very, when we do budgeting and everything, we'd always work towards those goals. That was always something that administration just emphasized all the time to us. So it was good for me. I felt great that they would do that.
Now this outreach, you're talking about the satellite clinics?
Yeah, the clinics.
Yeah, is Central Supply responsible for those?
Yes, we are. We supply the products and everything to all the outside areas, whether it's University Station or the West Side Clinic or the East Side, all those people we do.
There are pharmacies in each?
Yeah, there's pharmacies and there's medical and surgical supplies, there's linens, even sports medicine, we supply those with medicine, with linens and things. So.
This is such a major part of running a system like this.
Well, it is. There's a lot to it.
I should say.
We also, you know, over the years, again, one of the things that's kind of a buzzword is JIT, just-in-time inventories. And we start, in order to be more efficient, we did away with a lot of our inventories and reduced our inventories and went to a just-in-time system where indeed a lot of these things would be, we'd order them today and we'd use them tomorrow. And that's how it would work. And we worked very carefully with a group here in the Wanakee area, Medics at that time, it's now been sold, but Medics, they would furnish us all of our medical and surgical supplies in a just-in-time system where everything was computerized. we would use it. They would get a list of items that we would use, and they would replace those items. That's how that would work on a daily basis. And they would supply us about $1 million worth of supplies a month. And that, you know, that fed into university hospitals, and then the university hospital would divert all that supplies out to a lot of these outside outreach areas.
So it all came into the main hospital, and then you transported it to the outreach area?
To the beginning, that's the way it started. And then we later, we decided why should it come to University Hospital? And then we start having the medics deliver right to the outside areas. And we were to the point once where we would put, everything was barcoded. So we were once where indeed they would put it on the shelf, put things right on the shelf that was a nurse or anybody that come and get something would barcode it. That would then go into the company for an order, and the next day they would get those items that they took off the shelf. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's how some of the inventories were held down. That's some of the new concepts that we used. And then we, University Hospitals also got involved in a consortium, a buying consortium. And we did that, it's now in Texas, its headquarters is. But indeed, mainly our drugs were the biggest, first area that we really tackled with the consortium. And Dave Zills and the group in pharmacy did an excellent job of setting that system together and saving not only the hospital but patients a lot of money and over the years. Getting involved in that consortium, that buying consortium. But also another part of the buying consortium is they had benchmarks. They had all these hospitals in the country that would work with them, with the consortium. So they all set up data and statistics so you could use it as benchmarking. You know, you could see how University Hospitals is doing against MD Anderson Hospital in Texas. See a need for using too many supplies or too many drugs, or we could benchmark against different hospitals, which was fantastic also. So.
Were there studies then that illustrated how many of certain medications were being used in different areas?
Oh, yeah. We did lots and lots of work, and they're still doing work on that now, right now today, yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, it is. And medications is probably one of the biggest dollar volume.
Oh, my, yes.
Budget items that the university has. So,
does the university pricing then, because of this consortium,
it helps?
Keeps the prices down?
Yeah. Usually our pricing systems keeps it lower, not down. I mean, it's
down
fantastic.
Now.
Drugs are just very expensive. But usually they have a cost plus a fee system, whatever they do. And so indeed, it was reasonable. So if we got it at a lower cost, that cost would be passed on to whoever is using it. And our fees were pretty, we might play with them or use them, change them on a yearly budget thing, but they were reasonable anyway.
Very, very interesting. So now, have you retired?
Retired in 1998, and I've loved every minute of it. I still probably weekly go to the University Hospital, but I miss the people a lot. So I do spend some time on them, just like everybody else. You know, I have to come back, so I come back. Things have changed. I also, on retirement, there's things I wanted to do. The first year I retired, I did some mentoring in the elementary school system for a year. And the second year, I did mentoring in the middle school system for a year. Last year, the third year, I went back to the school pharmacy and taught a course, helped teach a course in the fall semester. And so I just have many things that we're doing. We're traveling a lot. Not a lot, but as much as we always did, or even a little more, actually, now.
Very involved with the retired faculty group?
Yeah, I was.
Was? Also not, is that past?
I, I, uh, I resigned from the health committee. It just it got to the point where they needed some new thoughts and new ideas, and so I'm working out with sports medicine about 2 hours every day now, so and I'm doing good over there, and I love it. It's like a social gathering over there too, because everybody you know you sit and talk all the time, and so it's a fun time.
So, oh, that's wonderful.
And family, you know, our families, our kids are growing, their families are growing and buying new houses. So I spend time cleaning up the yards now for spring, and each of their yards. If I do one, I have to do the other. So I have to do all those kinds of things.
Andrew's
in Milwaukee. They live in Elm Grove. They just bought a new home in Elm Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And
Sarah, where?
Sarah lives on the north side of Madison, off Esch Avenue, or Esch Street, I guess it is. And she works for the education travel people. The one you see in the paper, all that travel education group, she's their accountant. She does their accounting. But everybody's healthy and everybody's happy. And it's a good time in their lives. They're busy, but Andrew and his wife are a little more on the professional line, and they're busy beyond belief. And I don't know how the young people can do that anymore, but they are busy. And Sarah's a little more, and Sarah and Jim are a little more laid back, and they're enjoying life, I think, more.
Could well be. Well, you've enjoyed life.
Oh, yeah. It's been...
Certainly as busy as anybody could be.
Oh, I'm on a number of boards, too. You know, I'm on an insurance board. I'm still on the insurance board for Wisconsin Employees Incorporated, which is an insurance that's offered through the university to employees of the university. I'm the president of that, and I've been president of that now for 8-9 years. And so I enjoy that contact, and I'm on the board of directors here at Tamarack, and I've been on that for 4 years now, so... And I enjoyed that too. So I got lots of things going.
You're glad you came to Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. Wisconsin's our home now. We do get back to North Dakota though once in a while. And when we have our family reunions in North Dakota, we get 700 or 900 people together all at one time. We tour the farms, and so we have a good time. It's a great time.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, our kids enjoy it. Because they can go back with us, actually, too. So.
I had someone tell me years ago that Minot was the place to live.
It's very nice. I'm not sure it's the place to live.
I think Madison is.
It's not. I don't think it's as nice as Madison, so, but it is very nice. I still have a lot of good friends there. So.
Good.
I used to threaten the kids. Threaten the kids that I'd move them back to Minot if indeed they didn't behave, you know. So, and it never worked out. We never did move back to Minot, so.
Good. Well, this wraps up my questions. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No. It's just been delightful. I just appreciate it, actually. I think it's a great idea and the whole concept that you're doing. So,
are there any of the people that you worked with that you want to mention particularly? You mentioned Gordon Durzon.
I think probably one of the individuals that had the most influence on my pharmacy career was probably David Zills. David is just a dynamite person. I mean, he's going 100 miles an hour all the time, and still today he's doing that, but he's a great person. He's got great insight. He's he can look to the future very well, and he's just a great person. Mary Ann Zills, his wife, also is a very good friend of mine. She's very positive, too, for the university and the university hospitals, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
You had a lot of different deans over the years. Did they change the way you did things?
I think not. I think they were all pretty understanding. It seems that the deans in the School of Pharmacy are all pretty flexible with their staff. I mean, they'll let you do things. You have to, certain things you have to always do, but indeed they'll let you sprout your wing and go in different directions and have your own ideas. So Dr. Perlman is probably one that, not really an outsider, but when he came in, people thought he would probably change things different But he didn't really change things. Things just kept flowing right along. We've had a lot of emphasis over the years was on industry. And I think over the last maybe 8 or 9 years, it's become clinical pharmacy is more of an emphasis. The industry-related people are for graduate students that are, a lot of foreign students that are probably going into pharmaceutical industry outside this country, actually, mm-hmm. that are training. Whereas the clinical part is mostly people going out into the hospitals in this country. And so they've emphasized, I think, I have a feeling that that's the way they've gone. They've really supported and emphasized hospital graduate programs, hospital pharmacy, clinical programs.
What about the deans in the medical school? Did you have much to do with them?
Not there much to do with them, but I knew a lot of them. You end up knowing all of them. But I don't. Dean Farrell right now is. I think he's a very good dean. You got that on tape, but he's got a tough group of people to handle.
Oh yes.
I always, when I looked at the doctors, I'd always say there's a certain group that are prima donnas, and they're very difficult to control. But he can surely handle. He's surely handled and done a good job of monitoring and steering them in the right direction, I think, for the medical school. So it's a tough job. That's a very difficult job.
Well, I'm sure it is. Having been married to a doctor, I think a lot of them went into medicine because they wanted to do their own thing. And
absolutely.
Then you get a whole bundle of them under one roof, and each one wants to do his own thing. It must be very hard.
And it is. I think it is, too. So, but we've got a wonderful medical school here. We've trained a lot of great people, so it's been good. It's been great for me.
Good.
From a person from North Dakota that end up here is it's my privilege, actually.
You so. And Tom Daschle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. He's South Dakota.
Oh, is he South Dakota?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what's the matter.
Yeah, that's the difference, yeah.
All right. Are we through, Don?
I think we're finished. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate your time.
Yeah.